Anderson shone his light on a copper plate mounted on the door. The plate was covered with verdigris, but the old marking was legible. SBB-4.
SBB-4, Anderson said.
Which one is SBB-13?
Sato asked, faint wisps of steam curling out of her mouth in the cold subterranean air. Anderson turned the beam toward the south end of the corridor.
Down there.
Langdon peered down the narrow passage and shivered, feeling a light sweat despite the cold. As they moved through the phalanx of doorways, all of the rooms looked the same, doors ajar, apparently abandoned long ago. When they reached the end of the line, Anderson turned to his right, raising the beam to peer into room SBB-13. The flashlight beam, however, was impeded by a heavy wooden door. Unlike the others, the door to SBB-13 was closed. This final door looked exactly like the others, heavy hinges, iron handle, and a copper number plate encrusted with green. The seven characters on the number plate were the same characters on Peter's palm upstairs. SBB-XIII. Please tell me the door is locked, Langdon thought. Sato spoke without hesitation.
Try the door.
The police chief looked uneasy, but he reached out, grasped the heavy iron handle, and pushed down on it. The handle didn't budge. He shone the light now, illuminating a heavy, old-fashioned lock plate and keyhole.
Tried the master key, Sato said.
Anderson produced the main key from the entry door upstairs, but it was not even close to fitting.
Am I mistaken?
Sato said, her tone sarcastic.
Or shouldn't security have access to every corner of a building in case of emergency?
Anderson exhaled and looked back at Sato.
Ma'am, my men are checking for a secondary key, but...
Shoot the lock,
she said, nodding toward the key plate beneath the lever. Langdon's pulse leaped. Anderson cleared his throat, sounding uneasy.
Ma'am, I'm waiting for news on a secondary key. I'm not sure I'm comfortable blasting our way into...
Perhaps you'd be more comfortable in prison for obstructing a CIA investigation.
Anderson looked incredulous. After a long beat, he reluctantly handed the light to Sato and unsnapped his holster.
Wait,
Langdon said, no longer able to stand idly by. Think about it. Peter gave up his right hand rather than reveal whatever might be behind this door. Are you sure we want to do this? Unlocking this door is essentially complying with the demands of a terrorist.
Do you want to get Peter Solomon back?
Sato asked. Of course, but...
Then I suggest you do exactly what his captor is requesting.
Unlock an ancient portal? You think this is the portal? Sato shone the light in Langdon's face.
Professor, I have no idea what the hell this is. Whether it's a storage unit or the secret entrance to an ancient pyramid, I intend to open it. Do I make myself clear?
Langdon squinted into the light and finally nodded. Sato lowered the beam and redirected it at the door's antique keyplate.
Chief, go ahead.
Still looking averse to the plan, Anderson extracted his sidearm very, very slowly, gazing down at it with uncertainty.
Oh, for God's sake!
Sato's tiny hands shot out, and she grabbed the weapon from him. She stuffed the flashlight into his now empty palm.
Shine the damned light!
She handled the gun with the confidence of someone who had trained with weapons, wasting no time turning off the pistol's safety, cocking the weapon, and aiming at the lock.
Wait!
Langdon yelled. But he was too late. The gun roared three times. Langdon's eardrums felt like they had exploded.
Is she insane?
The gunshots in the tiny space had been deafening. Anderson also looked shaken, his hand wavering a bit as he shone the flashlight on the bullet-riddled door. The lock mechanism was now in tatters, the wood surrounding it entirely pulverized. The lock had released, the door now having fallen ajar. Sato extended the pistol and pressed the tip of the barrel against the door, giving it a push. The door swung fully into the blackness beyond. Langdon peered in but could see nothing in the darkness. What in the world is that smell? An unusual fetid odor wafted out of the darkness. Anderson stepped into the doorway and shone the light on the floor, tracing carefully down the length of the barren dirt floor. This room was like the others, a long, narrow space. The side walls were rugged stone, giving the room the feel of an ancient prison cell. But that smell.
There's nothing here,
Anderson said, moving the beam farther down the chamber floor. Finally, as the beam reached the end of the floor, he raised it up to illuminate the chamber's farthest wall.
My God!
Anderson shouted. Everyone saw it and jumped back. Langdon stared in disbelief at the deepest recess of the chamber. To his horror, something was staring back. Chapter 36.
What in God's name?
At the threshold of SBB-13, Anderson fumbled with his light and retreated a step. Langdon also recoiled, as did Sato, who looked startled for the first time all night. Sato aimed the gun at the back wall and motioned for Anderson to shine the light again. Anderson raised the light. The beam was dim by the time it reached the far wall, but the light was enough to illuminate the shape of a pallid and ghostly face staring back at them through lifeless sockets. A human skull. The skull sat atop a rickety wooden desk positioned against the rear wall of the chamber. Two human leg bones sat beside the skull, along with a collection of other items that were meticulously arranged on the desk in shrine-like fashion. An antique hourglass, a crystal flask, a candle, two saucers of pale powder, and a sheet of paper. Propped against the wall beside the desk stood the fearsome shape of a long scythe, its curved blade as familiar as that of the Grim Reaper. Sato stepped into the room.
Well now, it appears Peter Solomon keeps more secrets than I imagined.
Anderson nodded, inching after her.
Talk about skeletons in your closet.
He raised the light and surveyed the rest of the empty chamber.
And that smell, he added, crinkling his nose. What is it?
Sulfur, Langdon replied evenly behind them. There should be two saucers on the desk. The saucer on the right will contain salt, and the other sulfur. Sato wheeled in disbelief.
How the hell would you know that?
Because, ma'am, there are rooms exactly like this all over the world. One story above the sub-basement, Capitol security guard Nunez escorted the architect of the Capitol, Warren Bellamy, down the long hallway that ran the length of the eastern basement. Nunez could have sworn that he had just heard three gunshots down here, muffled and underground. There's no way.
Sub-basement door is open, Bellamy said, squinting down the hallway at a door that stood ajar in the distance.
Strange evening indeed, Nunez thought. Nobody goes down there.
I'll be glad to find out what's going on, he said, reaching for his radio.
Go back to your duties, Bellamy said. I'm fine from here.
Nunez shifted uneasily.
You sure?
Warren Bellamy stopped, placing a firm hand on Nunez's shoulder.
Son, I've worked here for 25 years. I think I can find my way.
Chapter 37. Malach had seen some eerie spaces in his life, but few rivaled the unearthly world of Pod 3, Wet Pod. The massive room looked as if a mad scientist had taken over a Walmart and packed every aisle and shelf with specimen jars of all shapes and sizes. Lit like a photographic darkroom, the space was bathed in a reddish haze of safe light that emanated from beneath the shelves, filtering upward and illuminating the ethanol-filled containers. The clinical smell of preservative chemicals was nauseating.
This pod houses over 20,000 species, the chubby girl was saying. Fish, rodents, mammals, reptiles.
All dead, I hope,
Malach asked, making a show of sounding nervous. The girl laughed.
Yes, yes, all very much dead. I'll admit I didn't dare come in for at least 6 months after I started work.
Malach could understand why. Everywhere he looked, there were specimen jars of dead life forms. Salamanders, jellyfish, rats, bugs, birds, and other things he could not begin to identify. As if this collection were not unsettling enough on its own, the hazy red safe lights that protected these photosensitive specimens from long-term light exposure gave the visitor the feeling he was standing inside a giant aquarium, where lifeless creatures were somehow congregating to watch from the shadows.
That's a coelacanth, the girl said, pointing to a big plexiglass container that held the ugliest fish Malak had ever seen. They were thought to be extinct with the dinosaurs, but this was caught off Africa a few years back and donated to the Smithsonian.
Lucky you, Malak thought, barely listening. He was busy scanning the walls for security cameras. He saw only one, trained on the entry door. Not surprising, considering that entrance was probably the only way in.
And here is what you wanted to see, she said, leading him to the giant tank he had seen from the window. Our longest specimen.
She swept her arm out over the vile creature, like a game show host displaying a new car.
Architeuthis.
The squid tank looked like a series of glass phone booths had been laid on their sides and fused end to end. Within the long, clear plexiglass coffin hovered a sickeningly pale and amorphous shape. Malak gazed down at the bulbous, sack-like head and its basketball-size eyes.
Almost makes your coelacanth look handsome, he said.
Wait till you see her lid.
Trish flipped back the long lid of the tank. Ethanol fumes wafted out as she reached down into the tank and flipped a switch just above the liquid line. A string of fluorescent lights flickered to life along the entire base of the tank. Architeuthis was now shining in all her glory, a colossal head attached to a slithery mass of decaying tentacles and razor-sharp suckers. She began talking about how Architeuthis could beat a sperm whale in a fight. Malak heard only empty prattling. The time had come. Trish Dunn always felt a bit uneasy in Pod 3, but the chill that had just run through her felt different. Visceral. Primal. She tried to ignore it, but it grew quickly now, clawing deeply at her. Although Trish could not seem to place the source of her anxiety, her gut was clearly telling her it was time to leave.
Anyhow, that's the squid,
she said, reaching into the tank and turning off the display light.
We should probably get back to Catherine's.
A broad palm clamped hard over her mouth, yanking her head back. Instantly, a powerful arm was wrapped around her torso, pinning her against a rock-hard chest. For a split second, Trish went numb with shock. Then came the terror. The man groped across her chest, grabbing her keycard and yanking down hard. The cord burned the back of her neck before snapping. The keycard fell on the floor at their feet. She fought, trying to twist away, but she was no match for the man's size and strength. She tried to scream, but his hand remained tightly across her mouth. He leaned down and placed his mouth next to her ear, whispering,
"When I take my hand off your mouth, you will not scream. Is that clear?"
She nodded vigorously, her lungs burning for air.
"I can't breathe."
The man removed his hand from her mouth, and Trish gasped, inhaling deeply.
"Let me go," she demanded, breathless. "What the hell are you doing?"
"Tell me your PIN number," the man said.
Trish felt totally at a loss.
"Catherine, help! Who is this man?" "Security can see you," she said,
knowing full well they were out of range of the cameras, and nobody is watching anyway.
"Your PIN number," the man repeated. "The one that matches your keycard."
An icy fear churned in her gut, and Trish spun violently, wriggling an arm free and twisting around, clawing at the man's eyes. Her fingers hit flesh and raked down one cheek. Four dark gashes opened on his flesh where she scratched him. Then she realized the dark stripes on his flesh were not blood. The man was wearing makeup, which she had just scratched off, revealing dark tattoos hidden underneath.
"Who is this monster?"
With seemingly superhuman strength, the man spun her around and hoisted her up, pushing her out over the open squid tank, her face now over the ethanol. The fumes burned her nostrils.
"What is your PIN number?"
he repeated. Her eyes burned, and she could see the pale flesh of the squid submerged beneath her face.
"Tell me,"
he said, pushing her face closer to the surface.
"What is it?"
Her throat was burning now.
0804,
she blurted, barely able to breathe.
"Let me go. 0804.
"If you're lying,"
he said, pushing down farther, her hair in the ethanol now.
"I'm not lying,"
she said, coughing.
"August 4th. It's my birthday."
"Thank you, Trish."
His powerful hands clasped her head tighter, and a crushing force rammed her downward, plunging her face into the tank. Searing pain burned her eyes. The man pressed down harder, driving her whole head under the ethanol. Trish felt her face pressing into the fleshy head of the squid. Summoning all of her strength, she bucked violently, arching backward, trying to pull her head out of the tank. But the powerful hands did not budge.
I have to breathe.
She remained submerged, straining not to open her eyes or mouth. Her lungs burned as she fought the powerful urge to breathe in.
No, don't!
But Trisha's inhalation reflex finally took over. Her mouth flew open, and her lungs expanded violently, attempting to suck in the oxygen that her body craved. In a searing rush, a wave of ethanol poured into her mouth. As the chemicals gushed down her throat into her lungs, Trish felt a pain like nothing she had ever imagined possible. Mercifully, it lasted only a few seconds before her world went black. Malak stood beside the tank, catching his breath and surveying the damage. The lifeless woman lay slumped over the rim of the tank, her face still submerged in ethanol. Seeing her there, Malak flashed on the only other woman he had ever killed, Isabel Solomon. Long ago. Another life. Malak gazed down now at the woman's flaccid corpse. He grabbed her ample hips and lifted with his legs, hoisting her up, pushing forward, until she began to slide over the rim of the squid tank. Trish Dunn slithered headfirst down into the ethanol. The rest of her body followed, sloshing down. Gradually, the ripples subsided, leaving the woman hovering limp over the huge sea creature. As her clothing got heavier, she began to sink, slipping into the darkness. Bit by bit, Trish Dunn's body settled on top of the great beast. Malak wiped his hands and replaced the plexiglass lid, sealing the tank. Wet Pod has a new specimen. He retrieved Trish's keycard from the floor and slipped it in his pocket. 0804. When Malak had first seen Trish in the lobby, he'd seen a liability. Then he'd realized her keycard and password were his insurance. If Catherine's data storage room was as secure as Peter had implied, then Malak was anticipating some challenges persuading Catherine to unlock it for him. I now have my own set of keys. He was pleased to know he would no longer have to waste time bending Catherine to his will. As Malak stood up straight, he saw his own reflection in the window and could tell his makeup was badly mangled. It didn't matter anymore. By the time Catherine put it all together, it would be too late. Chapter 38.
This room is Masonic?
Sato demanded, turning from the skull and staring at Langdon in the darkness. Langdon nodded calmly. It's called a chamber of reflection. These rooms are designed as cold, austere places in which a Mason can reflect on his own mortality. By meditating on the inevitability of death, a Mason gains a valuable perspective on the fleeting nature of life. Sato looked around the eerie space, apparently not convinced.
This is some kind of meditation room?
Essentially, yes. These chambers always incorporate the same symbols. Skull and crossed bones. Scythe, hourglass, sulfur, salt, blank paper, a candle, etc. The symbols of death inspire Masons to ponder how better to lead their lives while on this earth.
It looks like a death shrine,
Anderson said. That's kind of the point. Most of my symbology students have the same reaction at first. Langdon often assigned them Symbols of Freemasonry by Berezniak, which contained beautiful photos of chambers of reflection.
And your students?
Sato demanded.
Don't find it unnerving that Masons meditate with skulls and scythes?
No more unnerving than Christians praying at the feet of a man nailed to a cross, or Hindus chanting in front of a four-armed elephant named Ganesh. Misunderstanding a culture's symbols is a common root of prejudice. Sato turned away, apparently in no mood for a lecture. She moved toward the table of artifacts. Anderson tried to light her way with the flashlight, but the beam was beginning to dim. He tapped the heel of the light and coaxed it to burn a little brighter. As the threesome moved deeper into the narrow space, the pungent tang of sulfur filled Langdon's nostrils. The sub-basement was damp, and the humidity in the air was activating the sulfur in the bowl. Sato arrived at the table and stared down at the skull and accompanying objects. Anderson joined her, doing his best to light the desk with the weakening beam of his flashlight. Sato examined everything on the table and then placed her hands on her hips, sighing.
What is all this junk?
The artifacts in this room, Langdon knew, were carefully selected and arranged. Symbols of transformation, he told her, feeling confined as he inched forward and joined them at the table. The skull, or caput mortuum, represents man's final transformation through decay. It's a reminder that we all shed our mortal flesh one day. The sulfur and salt are alchemical catalysts that facilitate transformation. The hourglass represents the transformational power of time. He motioned to the unlit candle. And this candle represents the formative primordial fire and the awakening of man from his ignorant slumber. Transformation through illumination.
And that?
Sato asked, pointing into the corner. Anderson swung his dimming flashlight beam to the giant scythe that leaned against the back wall. Not a death symbol, as most assume, Langdon said. The scythe is actually a symbol of the transformative nourishment of nature, the reaping of nature's gifts. Sato and Anderson fell silent, apparently trying to process their bizarre surroundings. Langdon wanted nothing more than to get out of the place. I realize this room may seem unusual, he told them, but there's nothing to see here. It's really quite normal. A lot of Masonic lodges have chambers exactly like this one.
But this is not a Masonic lodge, Anderson declared. It's the U.S. Capitol, and I'd like to know what the hell this room is doing in my building.
Sometimes Masons set aside rooms like this in their offices or private homes as meditation spaces. It's not uncommon. Langdon knew a heart surgeon in Boston who had converted a closet in his office into a Masonic chamber of reflection so he could ponder mortality before going into surgery. Sato looked troubled.
You're saying Peter Solomon comes down here to reflect on death?
I really don't know, Langdon said sincerely. Maybe he created it as a sanctuary for his Masonic brothers who work in the building, giving them a spiritual sanctuary away from the chaos of the material world. A place for a powerful lawmaker to reflect before making decisions that affect his fellow man.
Lovely sentiment,
Sato said, her tone sarcastic.
But I have a feeling Americans might have a problem with their leaders praying in closets with scythes and skulls.
Well, they shouldn't, Langdon thought, imagining how different a world it might be if more leaders took time to ponder the finality of death before racing off to war. Sato pursed her lips and carefully surveyed all four corners of the candlelit chamber.
There must be something in here besides human bones and bowls of chemicals, Professor. Someone transported you all the way from your home in Cambridge to be in this precise room.
Langdon clutched his day bag to his side, still unable to imagine how the package he carried might relate to this chamber. Ma'am, I'm sorry, but I don't see anything out of the ordinary here. Langdon hoped that now at last they could get to the business of trying to find Peter. Anderson's light flickered again, and Sato spun on him, her temper starting to show.
For Christ's sake, is it too much to ask?
She plunged her hand into her pocket and yanked out a cigarette lighter. Striking her thumb on the flint, she held out the flame and lit the desk's lone candle. The wick sputtered and then caught, spreading a ghostly luminescence throughout the constricted space. Long shadows raked the stone walls. As the flame grew brighter, an unexpected sight materialized before them.
Look,
Anderson said, pointing. In the candlelight, they could now see a faded patch of graffiti, 7 capital letters scrawled across the rear wall. V-I-T-R-I-O-L. Vitriol.
An odd choice of word,
Sato said, as the candlelight cast a frightening skull-shaped silhouette across the letters. Actually, it's an acronym, Langdon said. It's written on the rear wall of most chambers like this as a shorthand for the Masonic meditative mantra. Visita, interiora, terrae. Rectificando, invenius, occultum, lapidum. Sato eyed him, looking almost impressed.
Meaning?
Visit the interior of the earth, and by rectifying, you will find the hidden stone. Sato's gaze sharpened.
Does the hidden stone have any connection to a hidden pyramid?
Langdon shrugged, not wanting to encourage the comparison. Those who enjoy fantasizing about hidden pyramids in Washington would tell you that Occultum Lapidum refers to the Stone Pyramid, yes. Others will tell you it's a reference to the Philosopher's Stone, a substance alchemists believed could bring them everlasting life or turn lead into gold. Others claim it's a reference to the Holy of Holies, a hidden stone chamber at the core of the Great Temple. Some say it's a Christian reference to the hidden teachings of St. Peter, the rock. Every esoteric tradition interprets the stone in its own way. But invariably, the Occultum Lapidum is a source of power and enlightenment. Anderson cleared his throat.
Is it possible Solomon lied to this guy? Maybe he told them there was something down here, and there really isn't.
Langdon was having similar thoughts. Without warning, the candle flame flickered as if caught by a draft. It dimmed for a moment, and then recovered, burning brightly again.
That's odd, Anderson said. I hope no one closed the door upstairs.
He strode out of the chamber into the darkness of the hallway.
Hello?
Langdon barely noticed him leave. His gaze had been drawn suddenly to the rear wall. What just happened?
Did you see that?
Sato asked, also staring with alarm at the wall. Langdon nodded, his pulse quickening. What did I just see? A moment earlier, the rear wall seemed to have shimmered, as if a ripple of energy had passed through it. Anderson now strode back into the room.
No one's out there.
As he entered, the wall shimmered again.
Holy shit!
He exclaimed, jumping back. All three stood mute for a long moment, staring in unison at the back wall. Langdon felt another chill run through him as he realized what they were seeing. He reached out tentatively until his fingertips touched the rear surface of the chamber. It's not a wall, he said. Anderson and Sato stepped closer, peering intently. It's a canvas, Langdon said.
But it billowed,
Sato said quickly. Yes, in a very strange way. Langdon examined the surface more closely. The sheen on the canvas had refracted the candlelight in a startling manner because the canvas had just billowed away from the room, fluttering backward through the plane of the rear wall. Langdon extended his outstretched fingers very gently, pressing the canvas backward. Startled, he yanked his hand back. There's an opening.
Pull it aside,
Sato ordered. Langdon's heart pounded wildly now. He reached up and clutched the edge of the canvas banner, slowly pulling the fabric to one side. He stared in disbelief at what lay hidden behind it. My God. Sato and Anderson stood in stunned silence as they looked through the opening in the rear wall. Finally, Sato spoke.
It appears we've just found our pyramid.
Chapter 39. Robert Langdon stared at the opening in the rear wall of the chamber. Hidden behind the canvas banner, a perfectly square hole had been hollowed out of the wall. The opening, about 3 feet across, appeared to have been created by removing a series of bricks. For a moment in the darkness, Langdon thought the hole was a window to a room beyond. Now, he saw it was not. The opening extended only a few feet into the wall before terminating. Like a rough-hewn cubbyhole, the recessed niche reminded Langdon of a museum alcove designed to hold a statuette. Fittingly, this niche displayed one small object. About 9 inches tall, it was a piece of carved, solid granite. The surface was elegant and smooth, with four polished sides that shone in the candlelight. Langdon could not fathom what it was doing here. A stone pyramid?
From your look of surprise,
Sato said, sounding self-satisfied.
I take it this object is not typical within a chamber of reflection?
Langdon shook his head.
Then perhaps you would like to reassess your previous claims regarding the legend of a Masonic pyramid hidden in Washington?
Her tone now was almost smug. Director, Langdon replied instantly. This little pyramid is not the Masonic pyramid.
So, it is merely coincidence that we found a pyramid hidden at the heart of the U.S. Capitol in a secret chamber belonging to a Masonic leader?
Langdon rubbed his eyes and tried to think clearly. Ma'am, this pyramid doesn't resemble the myth in any way. The Masonic pyramid is described as enormous, with a tip forged of solid gold. Moreover, Langdon knew, This little pyramid, with its flat top, was not even a true pyramid. Without its tip, this was another symbol entirely. Known as an unfinished pyramid, it was a symbolic reminder that man's ascent to his full human potential was always a work in progress. Though few realized it, this symbol was the most widely published symbol on Earth, over 20 billion in print. Adorning every $1 bill in circulation, the unfinished pyramid waited patiently for its shining capstone, which hovered above it as a reminder of America's yet unfulfilled destiny and the work yet to be done, both as a country and as individuals.
"Lift it down,"
Sato said to Anderson, motioning to the pyramid.
"I want a closer look."
She began making room on the desk by shoving the skull and crossed bones to one side with no reverence whatsoever. Langdon was starting to feel like they were common grave robbers, desecrating a personal shrine. Anderson maneuvered past Langdon, reached into the niche, and clamped his large palms on either side of the pyramid. Then, barely able to lift at this awkward angle, he slid the pyramid toward him and lowered it with a hard thud onto the wooden desk. He stepped back to give Sato room. The director repositioned the candle close to the pyramid and studied its polished surface. Slowly she ran her tiny fingers over it, examining every inch of the flat top and then the sides. She wrapped her hands around to feel the back, then frowned in apparent disappointment.
"Professor, earlier you said the Masonic Pyramid was constructed to protect secret information."
"That's the legend, yes."
"So, hypothetically speaking, if Peter's captor believed this was the Masonic Pyramid, he would believe it contained powerful information."
Langdon nodded, exasperated. "Yes, although even if he found this information, he probably would not be able to read it. According to legend, the contents of the pyramid are encoded, making them indecipherable, except to the most worthy."
"I beg your pardon?"
Despite Langdon's growing impatience, he replied with an even tone. "Mythological treasures are always protected by tests of worthiness. As you may recall, in the legend of the Sword in the Stone, the stone refuses to give up the sword except to Arthur, who was spiritually prepared to wield the sword's awesome power. The Masonic Pyramid is based on the same idea. In this case, the information is the treasure, and it is said to be written in an encoded language, a mystical tongue of lost words, legible only to the worthy." A faint smile crossed Sato's lips.
"That may explain why you were summoned here tonight."
"I'm sorry?" Calmly, Sato rotated the pyramid in place, turning it a full 180 degrees. The pyramid's fourth side now shone in the candlelight. Robert Langdon stared at it with surprise.
"It appears," Sato said, "that someone believes you're worthy."
Chapter 40. What's taking Trish so long? Catherine Solomon checked her watch again. She'd forgotten to warn Dr. Abaddon about the bizarre commute to her lab, but she couldn't imagine the darkness had slowed them down this much. They should have arrived by now. Catherine walked over to the exit and heaved open the lead-lined door, staring out into the void. She listened for a moment, but heard nothing. "Trish?" she called out, her voice swallowed by the darkness. Silence. Puzzled, she closed the door, took out her cell phone, and called the lobby. "This is Catherine. Is Trish out there?" "No, ma'am," the lobby guard said. "She and your guest headed back about 10 minutes ago."
"Really?
I don't think they're even inside Pod 5 yet." "Hold on, I'll check." Catherine could hear the guard's fingers clicking on his computer keyboard. "You're right. According to Ms. Dunn's keycard logs, she has not yet opened the Pod 5 door. Her last access event was about 8 minutes ago at Pod 3. I guess she's giving your guest a little tour on his way in." Catherine frowned. Apparently. The news was a bit odd, but at least she knew Trish wouldn't be long in Pod 3. The smell in there is terrible.
"Thanks. Has my brother arrived yet?"
"No, ma'am, not yet."
"Thank you."
As Catherine hung up, she felt an unexpected twinge of trepidation. The uneasy feeling made her pause, but only for a moment. It was the same exact disquiet she'd felt earlier when she stepped into Dr. Abaddon's house. Embarrassingly, her feminine intuition had failed her there. Badly.
"It's nothing," Catherine told herself.
Chapter 41 Robert Langdon studied the stone pyramid. This isn't possible.
An ancient encoded language?
Sato said, without looking up.
Tell me, does this qualify?
On the newly exposed face of the pyramid, a series of 16 characters was precisely engraved into the smooth stone. Beside Langdon, Anderson's mouth now gaped open, mirroring Langdon's own shock. The security chief looked like he had just seen some kind of alien keypad.
Professor,
Sato said,
I assume you can read this?
Langdon turned. Why would you assume that?
Because you were brought here, Professor. You were chosen. This inscription appears to be a code of some sort. And considering your reputation, it seems obvious to me that you were brought here to decipher it.
Langdon had to admit that after his experiences in Rome and Paris, he'd received a steady flow of requests asking for his help deciphering some of history's great unsolved codes. The Phaistos disk, the Dorabella cipher, the mysterious Voynich manuscript. Sato ran her finger over the inscription.
Can you tell me the meaning of these icons?
They're not icons, Langdon thought. They're symbols. The language was one he had recognized immediately. An encrypted cipher language from the 17th century. Langdon knew very well how to break it. Ma'am, he said, feeling hesitant, this pyramid is Peter's private property.
Private or not, if this code is indeed the reason you were brought to Washington, I am not giving you a choice in the matter. I want to know what it says.
Sato's BlackBerry pinged loudly, and she yanked the device from her pocket, studying the incoming message for several moments. Langdon was amazed that the Capitol building's internal wireless network provided service this far down. Sato grunted and raised her eyebrows, giving Langdon an odd look.
Chief Anderson,
she said, turning to him.
A word in private, if I may.
The director motioned for Anderson to join her, and they disappeared into the pitch-black hallway, leaving Langdon alone in the flickering candlelight of Peter's Chamber of Reflection. Chief Anderson wondered when this night would end. A severed hand in my rotunda? A death shrine in my basement? Bizarre engravings on a stone pyramid? Somehow the Redskins game no longer felt significant. As he followed Sato into the darkness of the hall, Anderson flicked on his flashlight. The beam was weak, but better than nothing. Sato led him down the hall a few yards, out of sight of Langdon.
Have a look at this,
she whispered, handing Anderson her BlackBerry. Anderson took the device and squinted at the illuminated screen. It displayed a black-and-white image, the X-ray of Langdon's bag that Anderson had requested be sent to Sato. As in all X-rays, the objects of greatest density appeared in the brightest white. In Langdon's bag, a lone item outshone everything else. Obviously extremely dense, the object glowed like a dazzling jewel in a murky jumble of other items. Its shape was unmistakable.
He's been carrying that all night?
Anderson looked over at Sato in surprise.
Why didn't Langdon mention this?
Damn good question,
Sato whispered.
The shape, it can't be a coincidence.
No,
Sato said, her tone angry now.
I would say not.
A faint rustle in the corridor drew Anderson's attention. Startled, he pointed his flashlight down the black passageway. The dying beam revealed only a deserted corridor, lined with open doors.
Hello?
Anderson said.
Is somebody there?
Silence. Sato gave him an odd look, apparently having heard nothing. Anderson listened a moment longer, and then shook it off. I've got to get out of here. Alone in the candle-lit chamber, Langdon ran his fingers over the sharply carved edges of the pyramid's engraving. He was curious to know what the message said, and yet he was not about to intrude on Peter Solomon's privacy any more than they already had. And why would this lunatic care about this small pyramid anyway?
We have a problem, Professor,
Sato's voice declared loudly behind him.
I've just received a new piece of information, and I've had enough of your lies.
Langdon turned to see the OS director marching in, BlackBerry in hand and fire in her eyes. Taken aback, Langdon looked to Anderson for help. But the chief was now standing guard at the door, his expression unsympathetic. Sato arrived in front of Langdon and thrust her BlackBerry in his face. Bewildered, Langdon looked at the screen, which displayed an inverted black-and-white photograph, like a ghostly film negative. The photo looked like a jumble of objects, and one of them shone very brightly. Though askew and off-center, the brightest object was clearly a little, pointed pyramid. A tiny pyramid? Langdon looked at Sato. What is this? The question seemed only to incense Sato further.
You're pretending you don't know?
Langdon's temper flared. I'm not pretending anything. I've never seen this before in my life.
Bullshit!
Sato snapped, her voice cutting through the musty air.
You've been carrying it in your bag all night.
I... Langdon stalled, mid-sentence. His eyes moved slowly down to the day bag on his shoulder. Then he raised them again to the blackberry. My God. The package. He looked more closely at the image. Now he saw it. A ghostly cube enclosing the pyramid. Stunned, Langdon realized he was looking at an X-ray of his bag, and also of Peter's mysterious cube-shaped package. The cube was, in fact, a hollow box, containing a small pyramid. Langdon opened his mouth to speak, but his words failed him. He felt the breath go out of his lungs as a new revelation struck him. Simple, pure, devastating. My God. He looked back at the truncated stone pyramid on the desk. Its apex was flat, a small, square area, a blank space symbolically awaiting its final piece. That piece which would transform it from an unfinished pyramid into a true pyramid. Langdon now realized the tiny pyramid he was carrying was not a pyramid at all. It's a capstone. At that instant, he knew why he alone could unlock the mysteries of this pyramid. I hold the final piece. And it is indeed a talisman. When Peter had told Langdon the package contained a talisman, Langdon had laughed. Now he realized his friend was right. This tiny capstone was a talisman, but not the magic kind, the far older kind. Long before talisman had magical connotations, it had another meaning, completion. From the Greek telesma, meaning complete, a talisman was any object or idea that completed another and made it whole, the finishing element. A capstone, symbolically speaking, was the ultimate talisman, transforming the unfinished pyramid into a symbol of completed perfection. Langdon now felt an eerie convergence that forced him to accept one very strange truth. With the exception of its size, the stone pyramid in Peter's chamber of reflection seemed to be transforming itself, bit by bit, into something vaguely resembling the Masonic pyramid of legend. From the brightness with which the capstone shone on the X-ray, Langdon suspected it was made of metal. A very dense metal. Whether or not it was solid gold, he had no way of knowing, and he was not about to let his mind start playing tricks on him. This pyramid is too small. The code's too easy to read, and it's a myth, for heaven's sake. Sato was watching him.
For a bright man, Professor, you've made some dumb choices tonight. Lying to an intelligence director? Intentionally obstructing a CIA investigation?
I can explain if you'll let me.
You will be explaining at CIA headquarters. As of this moment, I am detaining you.
Langdon's body went rigid. You can't possibly be serious.
Deadly serious. I made it very clear to you that the stakes tonight were high, and you chose not to cooperate. I strongly suggest you start thinking about explaining the inscription on this pyramid, because when we arrive at the CIA...
She raised her BlackBerry and took a close-up snapshot of the engraving on the stone pyramid.
My analysts will have had a head start.
Langdon opened his mouth to protest, but Sato was already turning to Anderson at the door.
Chief,
she said,
put the stone pyramid in Langdon's bag and carry it. I'll handle taking Mr. Langdon into custody. Your weapon, if I may.
Anderson was stone-faced as he advanced into the chamber, unsnapping his shoulder holster as he came. He gave his gun to Sato, who immediately aimed it at Langdon. Langdon watched as if in a dream. This cannot be happening. Anderson now came to Langdon and removed the day bag from his shoulder, carrying it over to the desk and setting it on the chair. He unzipped the bag, propped it open, and then hoisted the heavy stone pyramid off the desk and into the bag, along with Langdon's notes and the tiny package. Suddenly there was a rustle of movement in the hallway. A dark outline of a man materialized in the doorway, rushing into the chamber and approaching fast behind Anderson. The chief never saw him coming. In an instant, the stranger had lowered his shoulder and crashed into Anderson's back. The chief launched forward, his head cracking into the edge of the stone niche. He fell hard, crumpling on the desk, sending bones and artifacts flying. The hourglass shattered on the floor. The candle toppled to the floor, still burning. Sato reeled amid the chaos, raising the gun, but the intruder grabbed a femur and lashed out with it, striking her shoulder with the leg bone. Sato let out a cry of pain and fell back, dropping the weapon. The newcomer kicked the gun away and then wheeled toward Langdon. The man was tall and slender, an elegant African-American whom Langdon had never seen before in his life.
"Grab the pyramid," the man commanded. "Follow me."
Chapter 42. The African-American man leading Langdon through the capital's subterranean maze was clearly someone of power. Beyond knowing his way through all the side corridors and back rooms, the elegant stranger carried a key ring that seemed to unlock every door that blocked their way. Langdon followed, quickly running up an unfamiliar staircase. As they climbed, he felt the leather strap of his day bag cutting hard into his shoulder. The stone pyramid was so heavy that Langdon feared the bag's strap might break. The past few minutes defied all logic, and now Langdon found himself moving on instinct alone. His gut told him to trust this stranger. Beyond saving Langdon from Sato's arrest, the man had taken dangerous action to protect Peter Solomon's mysterious pyramid, whatever the pyramid may be. While his motivation remained a mystery, Langdon had glimpsed a telltale shimmer of gold on the man's hand, a Masonic ring, the double-headed phoenix, and the number 33. This man and Peter Solomon were more than trusted friends. They were Masonic brothers of the highest degree. Langdon followed him to the top of the stairs, into another corridor, and then through an unmarked door into a utilitarian hallway. They ran past supply boxes and bags of garbage, veering off suddenly through a service door that deposited them in an utterly unexpected world, a plush movie theater of some sort. The older man led the way up the side aisle, and out the main doors into the light of a large atrium. Langdon now realized they were in the visitor center, through which he had entered earlier tonight. Unfortunately, so was a Capitol Police officer. As they came face to face with the officer, all three men stopped, staring at one another. Langdon recognized the young Hispanic officer from the X-ray machine earlier tonight.
"Officer Nunez," the African-American man said. "Not a word. Follow me."
The guard looked uneasy, but obeyed without question. Who is this guy? The three of them hurried toward the southeast corner of the visitor center, where they arrived at a small foyer and a set of heavy doors blocked with orange pylons. The doors were sealed with masking tape, apparently to keep the dust of whatever was happening beyond out of the visitor center. The man reached up and peeled off the tape on the door. Then he flipped through his key ring as he spoke to the guard.
"Our friend, Chief Anderson, is in the sub-basement. He may be injured. You'll want to check on him."
"Yes, sir."
Nunez looked as baffled as he did alarmed.
"Most important, you did not see us."
The man found a key, took it off the key ring, and used it to turn the heavy deadbolt. He pulled open the steel door and tossed the key to the guard.
"Lock this door behind us. Put the tape back on as best you can. Pocket the key and say nothing. To anyone, including the chief. Is that clear, Officer Nunez?"
The guard eyed the key as if he'd just been entrusted with a precious gem.
"It is, sir."
The man hurried through the door, and Langdon followed. The guard locked the heavy bolt behind them, and Langdon could hear him reapplying the masking tape.
"Professor Langdon," the man said as they strode briskly down a modern-looking corridor that was obviously under construction. "My name is Warren Bellamy. Peter Solomon is a dear friend of mine."
Langdon shot a startled glance at the stately man.
"You're Warren Bellamy?"
Langdon had never met the architect of the Capitol, but he certainly knew the man's name.
"Peter speaks very highly of you," Bellamy said, "and I'm sorry we are meeting under these dreadful circumstances."
"Peter is in terrible trouble. His hand—"
"I know." Bellamy sounded grim. "That's not the half of it, I'm afraid."
They reached the end of the lit section of corridor, and the passageway took an abrupt left. The remaining length of corridor, wherever it went, was pitch black.
Hold on, Bellamy said, disappearing into a nearby electrical room, from which a tangle of heavy-duty orange extension cords snaked out, running away from them into the darkness of the corridor. Langdon waited while Bellamy rooted around inside. The architect must have located the switch that sent power to the extension cords, because suddenly the route before them became illuminated. Langdon could only stare. Washington, D.C., like Rome, was a city laced with secret passageways and underground tunnels. The passage before them now reminded Langdon of the Passetto Tunnel, connecting the Vatican to Castel San Angelo. Long, dark, narrow. Unlike the ancient Passetto, however, this passage was modern and not yet complete. It was a slender construction zone that was so long it seemed to narrow to nothing at its distant end. The only lighting was a string of intermittent construction bulbs that did little more than accentuate the tunnel's impossible length. Bellamy was already heading down the passage.
Follow me. Watch your step.
Langdon felt himself fall into step behind Bellamy, wondering where on earth this tunnel led. At that moment, Malak stepped out of Pod 3 and strode briskly down the deserted main corridor of the SMSC toward Pod 5. He clutched Trish's keycard in his hand and quietly whispered,
0804.
Something else was cycling through his mind as well. Malak had just received an urgent message from the Capitol building. My contact has run into unforeseen difficulties. Even so, the news remained encouraging. Robert Langdon now possessed both the pyramid and the capstone. Despite the unexpected way in which it had happened, the crucial pieces were falling into place. It was almost as if destiny itself were guiding tonight's events,
ensuring Malak's victory.
Chapter 43. Langdon hurried to keep pace with Warren Bellamy's brisk footsteps as they moved without a word down the long tunnel. So far, the architect of the Capitol appeared far more intent on putting distance between Sato and this stone pyramid than he did on explaining to Langdon what was going on. Langdon had a growing apprehension that there was far more going on than he could imagine. The CIA? The architect of the Capitol? 2 33rd-degree Masons? The shrill sound of Langdon's cell phone cut the air. He pulled his phone from his jacket. Uncertain, he answered, "Hello?" The voice that spoke was an eerie, familiar whisper.
"Professor, I hear you had unexpected company."
Langdon felt an icy chill. "Where the hell is Peter?" he demanded, his words reverberating in the enclosed tunnel. Beside him, Warren Bellamy glanced over, looking concerned, and motioning for Langdon to keep walking.
"Don't worry," the voice said. "As I told you, Peter is somewhere safe."
"You cut off his hand, for God's sake. He needs a doctor."
"He needs a priest," the man replied. "But you can save him. If you do as I command, Peter will live. I give you my word."
"The word of a madman means nothing to me."
"Madman? Professor, surely you appreciate the reverence with which I have adhered to the ancient protocols tonight. The hand of the mysteries guided you to a portal, the pyramid that promises to unveil ancient wisdom. I know you now possess it."
"You think this is the Masonic pyramid?" Langdon demanded. "It's a chunk of rock."
There was silence on the other end of the line.
"Mr. Langdon, you're too smart to play dumb. You know very well what you've uncovered tonight. A stone pyramid, hidden at the core of Washington, D.C., by a powerful Mason."
"You're chasing a myth. Whatever Peter told you, he told you in fear. The legend of the Masonic pyramid is fiction. The Masons never built any pyramid to protect secret wisdom, and even if they did, this pyramid is far too small to be what you think it is."
The man chuckled.
"I see Peter has told you very little. Nonetheless, Mr. Langdon, whether or not you choose to accept what it is you now possess, you will do as I say. I am well aware that the pyramid you are carrying has an encrypted engraving. You will decipher that engraving for me. Then, and only then, will I return Peter Solomon to you."
"Whatever you believe this engraving reveals," Langdon said, "it won't be the ancient mysteries."
"Of course not," he replied. The mysteries are far too vast to be written on the side of a little stone pyramid.
The response caught Langdon off guard.
But if this engraving is not the ancient mysteries, then this pyramid is not the Masonic pyramid. Legend clearly states the Masonic pyramid was constructed to protect the ancient mysteries.
The man's tone was condescending now.
Mr. Langdon, the Masonic pyramid was constructed to preserve the ancient mysteries, but with a twist you've apparently not yet grasped. Did Peter never tell you? The power of the Masonic pyramid is not that it reveals the mysteries themselves, but rather that it reveals the secret location where the mysteries are buried.
Langdon did a double take.
Decipher the engraving,
the voice continued,
and it will tell you the hiding place of mankind's greatest treasure.
He laughed.
Peter did not entrust you with the treasure itself, Professor.
Langdon came to an abrupt halt in the tunnel. Hold on. You're saying this pyramid is a map? Bellamy jolted to a stop now, too, his expression one of shock and alarm. Clearly the caller had just hit a raw nerve.
The pyramid is a map.
This map, the voice whispered, or pyramid, or portal, or whatever you choose to call it, was created long ago to ensure the hiding place of the ancient mysteries would never be forgotten, that it would never be lost to history.
A grid of 16 symbols doesn't look much like a map.
Appearances can be deceiving, Professor. But regardless, you alone have the power to read that inscription.
You're wrong, Langdon fired back, picturing the simplistic cipher. Anyone could decipher this engraving. It's not very sophisticated.
I suspect there is more to the pyramid than meets the eye. Regardless, you alone possess the capstone.
Langdon pictured the little capstone in his bag. Order from chaos? He didn't know what to believe anymore. But the stone pyramid in his bag seemed to be getting heavier with every passing moment. Malach pressed the cell phone to his ear, enjoying the sound of Langdon's anxious breathing on the other end.
Right now I have business to attend to, Professor. And so do you. Call me as soon as you have deciphered the map. We will go together to the hiding place and make our trade. Peter's life, for all the wisdom of the ages.
I will do nothing, Langdon declared, especially not without proof Peter is alive.
I suggest you not test me. You are a very small cog in a vast machine. If you disobey me, or attempt to find me, Peter will die. This I swear.
For all I know, Peter is already dead.
He is very much alive, Professor, but he desperately needs your help.
What are you really looking for? Langdon shouted into the phone.
Malach paused before answering.
Many people have pursued the ancient mysteries and debated their power. Tonight, I will prove the mysteries are real.
Langdon was silent.
I suggest you get to work on the map immediately,
Malach said.
I need this information today.
Today? It's already after 9 o'clock.
Exactly. Tempus fugit.
Chapter 44. New York editor Jonas Faulkman was just turning off the lights in his Manhattan office when his phone rang. He had no intention of picking up at this hour, that is, until he glimpsed the caller ID display. This ought to be good, he thought, reaching for the receiver.
Do we still publish you? Faulkman asked, half serious.
Jonas! Robert Langdon's voice sounded anxious. Thank God you're there. I need your help. Faulkman's spirits lifted.
You've got pages for me to edit, Robert?
Finally.
No, I need information. Last year I connected you with a scientist named Catherine Solomon, the sister of Peter Solomon.
Faulkman frowned. No pages.
She was looking for a publisher for a book on noetic science. Do you remember her?
Faulkman rolled his eyes.
Sure, I remember, and thanks a million for that introduction. Not only did she refuse to let me read the results of her research, she didn't want to publish anything until some magical date in the future.
Jonas, listen to me. I don't have time. I need Catherine's phone number right now. Do you have it?
I've got to warn you. You're acting a little desperate. She's great looking, but you're not going to impress her by...
This is no joke, Jonas. I need her number now.
All right. Hold on.
Faulkman and Langdon had been close friends for enough years that Faulkman knew when Langdon was serious. Jonas typed the name Catherine Solomon into a search window and began scanning the company's email server.
"I'm looking now," Faulkman said. "And for what it's worth, when you call her, you may not want to call from the Harvard pool. It sounds like you're in an asylum."
"I'm not at the pool,"